So we'd like to welcome you out to this Federal Society event. I'm sure most of you have been to a Federal Society event before, but just in case this is your first time, the Federal Society is a conservative and libertarian nonpartisan organization that believes in the principles of federalism, limited government, judicial restraint, and freedom. And we like debates, and so we're glad that we have one today. Our speakers, our participants. So on my far left, we have Mr. Ilya Shapiro. He is from the Cato Institute, where he is senior fellow there in constitutional studies, as well as the editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review, a nice publication to get in if you can. Before joining Cato, Mr. Shapiro was a special assistant slash advisor for the multinational force in Iraq on rule of law issues, and he has practiced privately in international, political, commercial, and antitrust litigation. Been in various journals and also has also written a lot for more, I guess, what we call the popular media, and has also appeared on numerous TV shows, including the Colbert Report. He got his JD from the University of Chicago and also holds a master's degree from London School of Economics and clerked on the Fifth Circuit. Our other participant will be Professor Fred Smith. Professor Smith received his JD from Stanford Law School. He clerked on the Second Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals, in Manhattan, and also clerked in the Middle District of Alabama in Montgomery. He also worked in a, says a litigation boutique, so that's a smaller firm, right, in Atlanta, and is a and was a former member of the Georgia Bar. He's also had some publications, and let's see, one, he was a finalist in the American Constitution Society's National Moot Court Competition. So we're pleased to have both of them today. The format's going to go like this. They'll have 15 to 20 minutes to make opening remarks. Then they'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And then we'll open it up to the audience for Q&A. So, Mr. Shapiro.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I think I've spoken at... Do you call it Bolt anymore? I know there was this whole rebranding thing at Berkeley Law. Whatever. Anyway, I've been here a couple of times. I understand now that you'd like to have your speakers come with, orange jumpsuited protesters and so forth. I apologize that I wasn't able to bring any of those. One thing that that James mentioned was that the Federal Society is for judicial restraint. I'm not sure that's the official policy of the Federal Society because, you know, you hear these terms, restraint or activism or neutrality, judicial minimalism, you know, certainly don't want them to have political bias. But what does it mean? Quite often, you know, activist is synonymous with any decision the speaker doesn't like. And restraint means, oh, the judge is being wise and, you know, oh, I agree with that decision, you know, coincidentally. So I want to make for you the case for an active rather than an activist judiciary. And indeed, to the extent my theory of constitutional interpretation or judicial action, you want to call it activist, well, you know, that's fine. That's just semantics, and I'll posit that judicial activism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Depending on where you stand on the political spectrum, you might be angry about unelected liberal judges rewriting the Constitution to reflect their own ill-conceived policy notions. Or you might be outraged that reactionary conservative judges are striking down laws and threatening all the progress that we've made on civil rights and civil liberties. Either way, you're likely to view the actions of these dangerous black-robed arbiters as judicial activism that must be stopped at all costs. But again, what is this judicial activism? If it's merely an invalidation of government action, as my former professor Cass Sunstein, now the regulatory czar, has proposed, he wrote this big kind of empirical study, try to have a neutral definition of activism and trying to figure out which judges are activists. He said, okay, anytime any legislation is struck down or federal agency action is overturned, we'll call that activist. Just kind of a neutral definition. you know, there's certain problems with that. So for, because, for example, if, you know, an agency is, you know, promoting liberal regulations, then striking it down might be conservative activism, or it might not, or, you know, if it's, or vice versa. I mean, it depends how, you know, the nub of the matter of what exactly is being acted upon. If it's, if it's a legislature acting that's Republican majority and it's being struck down, is that liberal activism? If it's, you know, being allowed to, I mean, you get the idea. There are some methodological problems with that kind of method. But if we accept that kind of neutral definition, striking down government action, then what are the beloved liberal troika of Miranda, Brown, and Roe, but unabashed activism? Right, each of those struck down government action. Conversely, if President Bush is correct that activism is disrespecting federalism and acting, quote, without regard for the will of the people and their elected representatives, then what would be more activist than the Bush Justice Department's opposition to California's medicinal marijuana or Oregon's right to die statute? You know, firm positions by the Bush DOJ. Examples like this abound. I mean, judicial activism is everybody's favorite bogeyman, and neither the left nor the right can provide a coherent definition beyond Justice Potter Stewart's famous dictum, which was issued in the context of obscenity, but really, as Sandra Day O'Connor proved, that could be extended to an entire non-philosophy of jurisprudence. I'll know it when I see it, right? Most people who use the term don't have a coherent definition. It typically, again, means just a judicial opinion with which I disagree. So you have, for example, Cass Sunstein, who thinks that, you know, there's conservative judges who are striking down agency actions that are activist. On the other hand, you have Robert Bork, right, the failed Supreme Court nominee and former Solicitor General and, you know, legal scholar, who thinks that any judicial opinion that defends or upholds an unenumerated right is activist. So anything that's not specifically listed in the Bill of Rights, if a judge says there's a right to that, well, that's activist. And, you know, the Ninth Amendment is an ink blot, essentially, because we don't know what it means, and therefore it means nothing. You know, those are kind of the extremes, right? But I think there's a third way. The purveyors of conventional punditry all miss the larger point. The role of the judiciary, in terms of constitutional interpretation, is to faithfully interpret and apply the Constitution, period. So, you know, if that means upholding a law, fine. If that means striking it down, fine. You know, activism is kind of doing something that's not supposed to be the judicial role, or not being faithful to the Constitution, which is no small task, in part because of the doctrinal mess that the Supreme Court has made. You know, again, whether a particular statute stands or falls is of no moment. Fidelity to the founding document should be the touchstone, not a circular debate over the virtues of judicial restraint, or as John Roberts put it at his confirmation hearings, modesty, right? Just calling balls and strikes, just, you know, being kind of a modest judicial role. You know, again, it's that again, where you stand on those sorts of debates depends on where you sit. As long as we accept that judicial review is constitutional and appropriate in the first place, you know, Marbury versus Madison, and how a judiciary is supposed to execute its role and ensure that government stays within its limited powers without the power of judicial review is beyond me, then we should only be concerned that a court gets it right, regardless of whether the correct interpretation leads to a challenge law being upheld, overturned, you know, the lower court being affirmed, reversed, what have you. For that matter, an honest court watcher shouldn't care whether one party wins or loses, to again paraphrase then-Judge Roberts at his confirmation hearing. The little guy should win when he's in the right, and the big guy should win when he's in the right. The framers' constitutional understanding, Federalist Paper 78 to 83, for example, are the primary ones which discuss the judicial role, provide the boundaries between proper and improper judicial activism. And so, to paraphrase those understandings, there's a few rules that I would apply about what courts should do. So first, review all state action, government action, that implicates liberty. then apply not a presumption of constitutionality, which is essentially what rational basis review is, you know, Congress, everything it does, we presume it's constitutional, but of liberty, because, after all, the Constitution is there to promote freedom and liberty, and like Federalist 51, which is my favorite Federalist paper, indeed my vanity plate on my car says Fed 51, right? If men were angels, we wouldn't need government. If angels govern men, well, no problem. Angels are doing everything fine. But in a world where men govern men, we first have to empower the government to do certain things, preserve the rule of law, rules of the game, that sort of thing, and then check that government, right? Well, how do we do that? We don't do it by presuming that everything the government does is okay. We do it by asking the question, does this promote liberty? And then void any exertion of power that's not expressly enumerated, because by definition, any exertion of power somehow infringes liberty. Now, sometimes that's a good thing, because when we criminalize something, that infringes on the criminal's liberty. But that's good, because he's detracting from the liberty of others, and we kind of have this sort of calculus, the basis of the criminal law. Give meaning to every word in the Constitution. There are no ink blots or technicalities or outmoded, antiquated portions. And only exercise judicial rather than legislative or executive power. What do I mean by that? Well, micromanaging war, for example, seems to be, however you draw that line, would be getting into the executive power. Or, there's less so now, but in the 60s and 70s, courts would require legislatures to pass budgets for their school systems or what have you, kind of micromanaging the legislative process. But why go through all this tedious process anyway, trying to be faithful to the Constitution, to the founding text, rather than just having a living Constitution or some other method of interpretation? The principal benefit of a written Constitution is that it subjects judges, legislatures, and executive officials to rules and principles that can't be literally changed by those same government officials. To be sure, judges of goodwill will and can read the same words and history and come up with different outcomes. Look at District of Columbia versus Heller, the big Second Amendment case. Right? Everybody, Scalia's majority opinion, Stevens's dissent, everybody purported to be doing an originalist analysis of what the right to keep and bear arms meant at the time of the ratification of the Second Amendment. And they came up with differing interpretations. That's okay. They were both engaged in good faith judging, I would say. But it's impossible to conceive of a process that would produce more consistent results or that would vest the judiciary with the credibility it needs to function. If we're simply saying, okay, judges, just, we're putting you up there because you're wise, use your wisdom purely, just use your judgment. That's what you're supposed to do. If we value the rule of law, there is simply no substitute for a good faith effort to apply the meaning of the Constitution, especially in light of changing circumstances and exigencies. Just because we now have the internet doesn't mean we don't understand what the Commerce Clause means. Just because we now have stagecoaches rather than horseback or horseless carriages after that doesn't mean each time some bit of the Constitution gets outmoded. Just because we now have 300 million people instead of 20 million. The best founding documents are the ones that are simplest. Look at the Brazilian Constitution, something like 300 pages and guarantees all sorts of different things. But I don't think the rule of law is stronger in Brazil than countries that have shorter constitutions. The dividing line, then, is not between judicial activism or abdication, which is equally a type of activism, like, for example, Kelo versus New London, right, where the court let the legislature go through with its taking, which I would argue is, violated all sorts of rights. But the judiciary abdicated its role, I'd say, by being restrained. So between activism and restraint, it's rather between legitimate and vigorous judicial action and illegitimate judicial imperialism, right? Thinking that, I'm the judge, I know better. For proof of this observation's legitimacy, look no further than the contrast between the public sentiment towards the very different activisms, or at least what people have called activisms, of the Warren and Rehnquist courts, respectively. You know, the Warren court expanded rights of criminals, found rights to privacy, all these different things. Sometimes ended up being good policy, but some of the law is kind of wishy-washy. The Rehnquist court had a short-lived federalism revolution, or as I like to put it, armed insurrection. It didn't really go very far. But nevertheless, a lot of opinions were, at least by liberal commentators, labeled as activist. And the public seems to have, by even now saying the court is too liberal, seems to have reconciled itself to the Rehnquist court and seen that as less activist than the Warren court. Now, ultimately, judicial power isn't a means to an end, be that end liberal, conservative, libertarian, what have you, but instead an enforcement mechanism for the strictures of a founding document. To that end, as it were, certain judicial decisions will produce unpopular outcomes. But the solution to that, in a republic with a founding document intended just as much to curtail democratic excesses as to empower democracy, in such a country, the proper response is to change the law. If we're governed by law and not men, and you don't like what decision the judges have made based on interpreting that law, then, pass a new law. Or if in the case of a constitutional decision, amend the Constitution. And now, people say, but it's too hard to amend the Constitution. That's because of the various constitutional perversions we've had going back to the New Deal and Progressive Era. If the decision was made to enact all sorts of facially unconstitutional legislation in the first place and just have courts go along with it, then obviously it becomes harder to pass actual constitutional amendments. Because look how we've effectively amended the Constitution without literally amending it. Any other method than this changing of the law when you don't like the legal result or changing the Constitution when you don't like the constitutional result leads to a sort of judicial abdication and the loss of those very rights and liberties that can only be vindicated through the judicial process. So think about, for example, the Lilly Ledbetter case, right? This is a few years ago. A woman had a lawsuit in suing Goodyear for sex discrimination in employment. She was being paid less over many, many years than men in her position. Got up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that in their interpretation of the statute at issue, the statute of limitation had run. So not that, she didn't have a case or she wasn't discriminated against, but, statute of limitations had run. This became a huge political issue. It became an issue in the 2008 election. And lo and behold, the first law that President Obama signed was the Lilly Ledbetter Fairness in Employment or Pay Discrimination Act or whatever the technical term is, which now you could argue over the policy of it, but it changed the statute of limitations. I mean, what it actually did was say that every time you got a new paycheck, a new statute of limitations would start running. There were alternatives that were proposed, but that's the one that won out. But that's a great result in terms of how our system is supposed to work. You don't like the Supreme Court's interpretation, change the law. Okay. Otherwise, you simply have judges who are exercising judicial power divorced from any authority given to them by the Constitution, and they're no better than an executive tyrant or an out-of-control legislature or anything else. I mean, any other method leads to kind of government or judging by pure force of will rather than by the consent of the governed or implied consent or protection for minority rights or whatever your theory is of where government gets its legitimacy to act. Or it leads to government by black-robed philosopher kings. And as Justice Scalia is fond of saying, even if we wanted that kind of rule, why in the world would we pick 9 lawyers for that job? There's a better way, whether we call it activism or, say, the proper role of an Article III judge. Thanks.
Uh,
Thank you for that, and thank you to the Federal Society for this invitation. I think in light of those remarks, this really isn't a debate necessarily about judicial activism, right? I'm not about to get up here and defend or take the position that we should never, that the judges should never be active, right? So it's really a debate about the role of a judiciary in a democratic society, and the role of a judiciary in a society and in a constitution that has a constitution that purports to guarantee to the states a republican form of government, right? So popular sovereignty and representative government, and in a system that guarantees popular sovereignty and representative government, under what circumstances is it legitimate for appointed individuals, or in some cases for one appointed individual, to overturn the legislation that has been duly enacted? Duly enacted by people who have also taken an oath to faithfully uphold the Constitution. We both agree that there's a role for judicial review, and I think we both agree that substituting one's own policy judgments for the law is always inappropriate. That said, I think we also probably agree that the phrase freestanding activism by itself is not very useful for many of the reasons that he just pointed out, right? And in addition to Cass Sunstein's attempt to quantify it, more recently, Corey Young has a piece in Northwestern Law Review that attempts to quantify judicial activism in terms of how frequently legislation is struck down. Now, another approach, though, is to say that judges should only strike down legislation when it's unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, this is a position that was taken by James Bradley Thayer. And the reason that he took that position was because if judges are too active in overturning democratically enacted legislation, then at some point, legislators and presidents and governors won't do their job. They won't faithfully uphold the Constitution because they know that if they overstep boundaries, that the courts will step in. And therefore, you're reducing the role for democratically enacted legislators to do their job in interpreting or at least applying faithfully the Constitution. I actually have a lot more sympathy for that view than Ilya. I believe that sometimes courts do have a duty to strike down legislation, even if reasonable people can disagree. And to me, the dividing line is, or the question is, when should courts invalidate statutes that reasonable people can disagree about the constitutionality of? And when should courts not do that? When should courts have a more active role or a less active role? Now, there are the ambiguities that are in the Constitution abound, right? I mean, you look at the word equal protection, and trying to answer that question just using text, it's pretty difficult. Right? Does it include some sort of anti-subordination principle? Does it include gender? On the face of it, it doesn't say it does, and it doesn't say it doesn't. Or does it only apply to race? Does it apply to the disabled? Does it only apply to laws that have a discriminatory purpose? Right? I mean, the language purpose does not appear in the Equal Protection Clause, but it's been interpreted to mean that. Does it apply to gender classifications? And if it does, does it apply to gender restrictions in marriage laws? So that's just one example. I mean, another example would be, you know, what does liberty mean? Does it only encompass physical constraints? Does it encompass state-created liberty interests? What about the freedom more broadly to be left alone? What does cruel mean? Who decides? Does it include the concept that punishment should be proportional to a crime? That is, would the death penalty be okay for stealing a bar of chocolate? Does it include the concept of whom a state may punish? That is, would it be okay to give the death penalty to a 7-year-old? What does unusual mean, right? What's the denominator when we're trying to decide what is unusual? Reasonable people can disagree about the meaning of these words. And to add another layer of complication, we have, of course, the Ninth Amendment, which says that just because a right is not enumerated in the Constitution doesn't mean that that right doesn't exist, right? Which Ilya also pointed out. Now, to add another layer of complication, the Constitution tells us about the scope of congressional action. And reasonable people, though, can disagree about those provisions, too. Right? It's not obvious on the face of the Interstate Commerce Clause what that means. Does interstate commerce mean only when one state is engaging in commerce with another state? That strikes me, using text alone, that strikes me as a plausible interpretation. Does it only apply to commercial activity that affects more national markets? Does it apply to activity that affects national markets that's not commercial in nature, but in its consequences is commercial, even though the activity itself isn't commercial? What about the tax power? Is it okay to attach tax consequences to certain conduct, like buying a home, or being married, or having kids, or donating to a campaign, or donating to a charity, rather, or having health insurance? Section 5 of the 14th Amendment allows Congress to pass legislation, appropriate legislation is the language, to enforce that provision. Who decides what's appropriate? Right? Does the Constitution thereby vest in Congress the ability to decide what is appropriate? Is it a political question to get into the muck of whether or not what Congress did with respect to Section 5, or does with respect to Section 5, is valid or not valid, or appropriate or inappropriate? And are judges actually getting involved in the legislative role when they try to decide whether Congress acted appropriately? Now, judges, by definition, therefore must apply judgment in all of these types of cases and many others. In my view, in deciding how to apply that judgment, the work of John Hart Ely is very useful. Because his view is that the problem with always relying on the legislature to take care of constitutional problems is that sometimes the legislature doesn't reflect the will of society, or the channels of political change can be clogged in a number of ways. Or there may be people who don't have an equal voice in government. And there are two consequences of that fact, that flow, rather, from that fact. The first is that it is my view that constitutional provisions that are designed to protect equality of rights and constitutional provisions that are designed to clear the channels of political change should be applied to government action even when reasonable people can disagree about the constitutionality. In those situations, judges should be faithful to the text, the history, and precedent without respect to whether or not reasonable people can disagree. By contrast, our constitutional design gives considerable voice to the rights of states. It's inherent in the design of the Constitution. By this I mean, if you look to the Senate, right? Every state has an equal voice in the Senate. And for our founders believed that was very consequential. Madison put it this way. He said, no legislation can be passed first without the consent of the majority of the people, referring to the House, and then with respect to the majority of the states. And he was referring to the Senate. Chief Justice Marshall actually said something very similar in McCulloch. He said that the states are, quote, represented in the Senate, and their sovereignties are represented in the Senate. As a result, I think that in situations that involve states' rights, if reasonable people can disagree about text, history, and precedent, then courts should be more deferential to legislatures in that context. Second, I believe that the ultimate minority in any society is the individual. And as a result, actually, Ilya and I agree on this point, constitutional provisions that are designed to protect individual liberty, including the First and the Second and Fourth and Fifth, should be applied rigorously, right, with attention to the text, history, and precedent, regardless of whether reasonable people can disagree. One concern I have, however, is that sometimes there are different mechanisms that courts have placed, or different barriers, rather, that courts have placed in the role of litigants who are attempting to enforce their constitutional rights. And by restricting the remedies that are available to people who are seeking their constitutional rights, courts, therefore, in effect, are also restricting the right itself. Right? So, you know, Chief Justice Marshall also told us, right, that for any right, there must be a remedy. Right? And Carl Llewellyn has said the same thing, right? If you don't have a remedy, then you really don't have a right. You can call it a right all you want, but if there's no remedy, there is no right. And there are a number of moments that, in my view, courts have unduly stepped in the way of litigants. One would be the context of sovereign immunity. Right? So the 11th Amendment says that the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any class or cases in law or equity between a citizen of one state and another state, or between a citizen or subject of a foreign state and a state. Right? So that's the language of the 11th Amendment, the judicial power of the United States. Despite that language, despite the fact that this provision begins, the judicial power of the United States, the Supreme Court has interpreted that language somehow to mean that to mean two very strange things. Number one, a citizen can't sue their own state, despite the very clear language of the 11th Amendment. And number two, Congress cannot pass legislation that allows people to sue states, even when that means that someone is suing a state in state court, right? Despite the language, the judicial power of the United States. And I don't think that there is any reasonable construction of the 11th Amendment that would lead to that view. The only way that you get there is to do what the court has actually been very candid about doing. Justice Scalia has said that the 11th Amendment stands not for what it says, but for the broad presuppositions for which it stands. And in my view, that is problematic. Another example would be the role of qualified immunity. There are a number of moments where the court has interpreted qualified immunity in ways that just aren't particularly tied to any type of constitutional provision. I mean, the words qualified immunity themselves appear nowhere in the Constitution. Another example would be what are called Bivens suits. So people are allowed to sue federal actors for different constitutional violations. But in recent years, courts have been increasingly stingy about when they will allow different Bivens remedies. So there's a case called Arar from the Second Circuit that came out last year that strongly implies that you don't have a remedy against a federal actor who violates different substantive due process rights. And the court went out of its way in Iqbal to say that they've never said that you have a Bivens right for a First Amendment violation, suggesting that that's now potentially on the chopping block as well. And that's concerning, right? Because again, there is no right if there is no remedy. Another example would be standing. Sure, the Constitution says that you have to have a case or controversy, but the court has gone very much further than that language to decide what constitutes a case or controversy before someone may be able to come into court, and I'm happy to say more about that, but I don't want to go over my time. And so with that, I mean, I guess just again, my basic point is that in a democratic society, there should be deference that is given to legislators because we should trust that they take their responsibility seriously to uphold the Constitution. And therefore, when reasonable people can disagree, the background principle should be when reasonable people disagree about constitutional text or history, then deference should go to the legislature. However, when you're dealing with a constitutional provision that is intended to clear the channels of political change or protect individual liberty, such as the Bill of Rights, that's a very different circumstance. And there, courts should faithfully apply the text, the history, and precedent without respect to whether reasonable people disagree. And I don't think the court has done that in the context of sovereign immunity or in Bivens cases, and in some instances in the case of qualified immunity. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for those remarks. Kind of a broad, high-level conversation we're having here, and I find myself agreeing with most of what Professor Smith has said, particularly with the examples of sovereign immunity and qualified immunity, Bivens. Standing, I think the court's pretty good, except for the Establishment Clause issues, but that's because its own Establishment Clause jurisprudence is a complete muddle. But if you kind of read between the lines of what he's saying and what I said, you do tease out one huge difference, and that is the presumption, okay? Professor Smith mentioned such things as, you know, when reasonable people disagree. Well, you know, when that happens, whoever bears the burden of persuasion or evidence or proof or what have you, loses because they haven't borne that burden. Whoever's challenging loses. I think that there should be a thumb on the scales of liberty at all times, and I guess I'm for less deference by the courts than Professor Smith has, less deference by the courts for the legislature than Professor Smith does. And that is because even though legislators have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, and that's perhaps one thing, the only thing I agree with Christine O'Donnell on. I do think that congressmen and senators do need to consider the constitutionality of any legislation that's presented to them. I probably agree with her that she's not a witch either, although I really don't have enough information to make a full determination. But look, this does go to the role of a judiciary in a free and democratic society, and in this, what does a Republican system of government mean? There's one other key thing that I don't know if you picked up on. Professor Smith seems to apply a different presumption on liberty provisions of the Constitution versus the rest, you know, meaning, I guess, the power or the structural provisions of the Constitution. That is a false dichotomy. Our Constitution is a holistic document. The entire thing, even before the Bill of Rights was added, is created to promote individual liberty. The powers and rights side are two sides of the same coin. Remember the debate about whether even to have a Bill of Rights. Why do we need this? We don't give government any powers to violate our rights. Furthermore, if you enumerate the rights, that'll, you know, disparage all these other ones. We can't enumerate every single right. Look, I have a right to wear a hat that's red. I have a right to wear not to wear a hat. You know, I have the right to get out of bed on the right side, on the left side. I mean, we can't just enumerate all these things. Okay, so we'll have the Ninth Amendment to, you know, do that. And to underline that we're not giving the states any more powers, we'll have, or the federal government any more powers, we'll have the Tenth Amendment. You know, the Ninth and Tenth Amendment taken together is pretty much the Constitution in a microcosm. We have a sea of liberty with islands of governmental authority to, you know, kind of keep the rules of the game in check. For example, the Commerce Clause. Okay, Professor Smith said that that was kind of nebulous or, you know, might change or what have you. The regulation of interstate commerce at the time of the founding of the ratification of the Constitution means to make regular commerce. Okay. That goes between states. Commerce doesn't mean manufacturing or trade or anything with a dollar sign attached to it as we now think of it in that context. It means trade in goods. The interstate trade in goods to make that regular. This was an anti-protectionism measure to prevent states from levying tariffs against each other and other trade barriers as kept happening under the Articles of Confederation and prevented us from having a more perfect union, as it were. What we now conceive of as the dormant commerce clause was really, you know, if you read the ratification debates, what that provision was all about. You know, it wasn't a sword so much for the federal government to go and, intrude on all areas of our life, where we now have to debate, you know, does this local economic activity have a substantial enough effect in the aggregate on interstate commerce if it's part of a comprehensive scheme and kind of, you know, how many angels dance on the head of that pin. It was a shield to protect, you know, to promote liberty, to promote trade and commerce and these sorts of things. Go back to political theory 101, okay? We all have our own 100% individual sovereignty, of which we delegate certain bits to the government to protect our rights against murderers, you know, national defense, sometimes public goods, these sorts of things. We delegate temporarily, enumerate these limited powers that we give to that other sovereign, to the government, okay? We retain all other powers. We have all of our full natural rights. To limit government power is to enhance our liberty. It's not a matter of presuming that everything that government does is constitutional. Well, no, Congress could have been wrong in its assessment of its own powers. We don't let Congress assess its own powers, even if it disagrees. Reasonably people disagree. Judge has to throw up his hands. No. The judge is paid to figure out, to make those hard calls about whether the Constitution permits the government to do that or not. The main liberty-protecting provisions of the Constitution, as understood in either 1789, 91, 1868, with the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, was not the Bill of Rights. It was the structural provisions of the Constitution. And so, having this thumb on the scales, presuming that anything that Congress does, as long as it might be reasonable, is going too far. It gives too much power to legislators, and it gives judges too much power. You know, they play this game of bifurcating our rights that started with Caroline Products footnote 4. You know, is this right fundamental? If it is, well, then government can't do what it's doing. If it's not fundamental, then a government can do what it's doing. I mean, it's not a principled way of judicial interpretation, and that's what the root of all of our, a lot of our disputes are.
Two things. So first, with respect to standing, in particular, what bothers me about current standing doctrine is that if a litigant's constitutional rights have been violated, okay, and it's not compensable with damages for whatever reason, maybe because they can't show that it violated clearly established law, which is something you have to show under qualified immunity. And that person wants to seek an injunction from a court to say, I don't want this to happen to me again. I want you to stop this practice that violates my constitutional rights and other people's constitutional rights. That litigant not only has to show that their constitutional rights have been violated before, they also have to show that their constitutional rights are likely to be violated again, right? And that's been read into standing and mootness. Mootness is kind of at that intersection. And so that's what I was referring to when I referred to standing doctrine, that I think is kind of at some point divorced from the Constitution and ends up restricting constitutional rights. But we do have a disagreement. We have a disagreement about what the institutional role of judges are and what judges' competitive or comparative advantage is. I happen to think that legislators have a role in applying to the Constitution faithfully. And I believe that if courts go too far, then legislators will not take that responsibility nearly as seriously as they should. And I think the reason why legislators do not take the responsibility seriously as they should is because they think that, well, if we go too far, then a court will step in. I just think that the language regulating interstate commerce, that judges, I teach law school, I love law schools, but I don't think that judges are inherently better. I don't think there's something inherent in the role of being a judge that makes them necessarily better at deciding what interstate commerce is than someone who's been elected to faithfully uphold the Constitution. I just don't. And that's why I believe in the background principle that when reasonable people can disagree, that we should defer to legislatures on a number of questions, and again, most notably, states' rights. So what's the, you know, and I have a reason for my dividing line, right? My dividing line between when we should have that deference and when we shouldn't is clear, right? We want legislators to reflect the public will. But there are circumstances when legislation may not reflect the public will, most notably when the channels of political change are blocked, right? So if you have a poll tax, right, or if you have separate schools that relegate one segment of society to a place where they're ultimately not able to express their voice, when the channels of political change are blocked, right, when groups of people are subjugated in our system such that it can hardly be called a Republican form of government, which happened throughout much of our history, then those are the circumstances where I think that even if reasonable people can disagree, we should apply the text, the history, and the precedent without respect to that. Thanks.
I'd like to open up the questions. So anybody, yeah.
Both of you seem to agree that it's inappropriate for a judge to substitute his own personal convictions for what established law is. But how widespread of a problem do you think that is? Judges do this maybe subconsciously without knowing.
Well, to a large extent, it's a red herring. I haven't heard anyone say that, maybe occasionally, but that, you know, judges should just put in their own policy preferences. I mean, that is kind of a straw man. The problem comes in where, for example, at Elena Kagan's confirmation hearing, this is the best line of questioning by Tom Colbert, who's not a senator from Oklahoma, who's not a lawyer. And maybe the thing we should do to make these hearings more relevant is to kick off all the lawyers and have others do the question. But anyway, yes, would it be constitutional for Congress to pass a law requiring you to have 3 servings of fruits and vegetables every day? I mean, you know, and she said, oh, that's a ridiculous law, I would never vote for it, that's stupid, you know, but she never said it was unconstitutional. That seems to be an easy question. You know, and I don't think she was, you know, playing political games or, you know, I might have to decide that at some point, you know, or whatever. I mean, she did. But it's, you know, if you take the Constitution seriously, there is just no way that that law can be constitutional. And yet, I've had debates in the context of the individual mandate, because obviously that's what the subtext of this is, where my interlocutors, you know, I actually got them to concede that, yeah, well, that would be constitutional. If something like that is constitutional, then the Constitution has no meaning. And so, you know, that perhaps is not substituting the judge's own policy views, but it's substituting the views of the view of a Constitution that doesn't mean what it says. As the Florida judge 2 weeks ago in rejecting the government's motion to dismiss said, it's an Alice in Wonderland conception of words. So it's, I don't know if, you know, particularly substituting policy views, but it's substituting a view of the relationship of the government to the people and the Constitution to the government that is one's own.
How widespread of a problem is it? I'm not sure how widespread it is, but it certainly happens. I'll give you one sort of weird example. So in Heller, all right, so I believe in the individual right to bear arms. I believe that it's contained in the Second Amendment. But in Heller, the court didn't just say that you have an individual right to bear arms. They said you have an individual right to bear arms in the home. Right? Now, if you look at the text of the Second Amendment, home appears nowhere therein. Maybe you could make a textual argument that because the Third Amendment protects the right not to have soldiers in the home, or that the Fourth Amendment protects the home, that maybe there's a broader constitutional value of the home, I don't know. But
it's in the penumbra termination.
Right, you can make a kind of penumbra type of argument about it. You know, in the tradition of Griswold on the right to privacy, but I don't think that
Justice Scalia would be comfortable saying that that's what he was doing. But either he was doing that, which is one mode of constitutional interpretation, or he was just he was exercising judgment as a judge to say, well, this doesn't mean just as a using my own judgment, this does not mean that people should have the right to have guns in schools or in courthouses or he was exercising a policy judgment in my view. To the extent that it's a problem, I think again where I have a serious problem with it, though, is again when it comes with respect to restricting remedies such that people can't vindicate their rights. And to me, sovereign immunity is just a very solid example of that. Qualified immunity is also an example of that, where the court, you read qualified immunity opinions that purport to be interpreting Section 1983. Section 1983 is the law that allows people to go into court and vindicate their constitutional rights against state actors. And how they get qualified immunity, it's policy. And they acknowledge that it's policy. Right? We're going to balance the following policy goals. And that strikes me as problematic. Another moment that I think we saw it, that's not quite in the constitutional context, but it does play a role in vindicating constitutional rights, is in Iqbal and interpreting Rule 8A2. Rule 8A2 says that you have to have a plain statement of the factual legal basis for your claim. And the court somehow read into that very high plausibility standard, right? Such that, and the court actually said that in deciding what's plausible, judges should exercise their own wisdom. The word wisdom actually appears in the opinion to decide in interpreting Rule 8A2. And that to me is a policy judgment, and it's a policy judgment that results in the restriction of individual rights, including individual constitutional rights. So those are examples where I do think it's problematic.
Well, there's a difference between, that's not a constitutional decision, that's the federal rules of civil procedure, which can be amended, and Arnold Spector has said that he's going to be gone soon anyway, but wants to amend pleading standards and things like this. I'm all for suing government actors, so I guess I mostly agree with them on some of those things. What was I going to say that jumped into my mind? Let's go for more questions.
My question is sort of more for Professor Smith, but for answer. You mentioned that that you think one of the problems where you have active is that the legislators somehow feel more inhibited. They don't. They somehow inhibit their lawmaking role. Is there any indication that's been happening? Because I feel like you might almost have the opposite result, where legislators say, "Well, there's no consistent line, of thought coming from the Supreme Court or from the judiciary, so we're just going to do what we feel like and say, there's no real control." I'm wondering if there's any evidence of that actually happening.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because I think that courts have been active long enough that it's hard to know. It's sort of one of those questions that it's hard to have empirical evidence for it. Because courts have been active so long, it's hard to know how Congress would react if they had to take their role to applying the Constitution faithfully. I guess my view, though, is that in a democratic society, why should there be that level of distrust in the people who folks have sent to express their will? Like, why should there be that level of distrust in their ability to make laws in accordance with the Constitution? It's not obvious to me. And it's not obvious to me that judges are just, they're way better at that. I think that judges can sometimes succumb to the will of supplanting their own policy views for the law.
Yeah.
They should have that suspicion because it's the government that has the force of a gun behind it. And we have a long tradition of that sort of skepticism. Again, go back to political theory 101. Where does the government get its legitimacy? It's not consent. It's not even implied consent. It's because it maximally guarantees the rights of minority interests. That's kind of
It's an imperfect, but it's the best way that we can justify the government having any sort of power, and given that it's humans governing humans. Professor Smith has put his finger on a very important issue. Legislators really don't consider the constitutionality of things. They just pass the buck, or they just don't care. Or, when Nancy Pelosi was asked, what do you think about the constitutional claims that are being raised about Obamacare? And she said, are you serious? Because, of course, it's the last refuge of the scoundrel who doesn't have any policy arguments to bring up that musty old constitution under glass, right? You read the congressional debates and the congressional record in the 19th century, and it's all about, do we have the power under the Constitution to do this? In 1887, I have notes of this because it's such a salient example, Grover Cleveland vetoed an appropriation of $10,000 for seeds to Texas farmers who had suffered terrible drought, saying, I can find no warrant for such appropriation in the Constitution. 20 years later, talking about a court now, the Supreme Court in the case of Kansas versus Colorado, the court said the proposition that there are legislative powers affecting the nation as a whole, although not expressed in the specific grant of powers, is in direct conflict with the doctrine that this is a government of enumerated powers. Okay, people took this idea seriously at one point. Contrast that with the New Deal, and when there were discussions in the administration and in the Roosevelt Justice Department about whether to push certain pieces of legislation through, even though there are constitutional qualms, or seek a constitutional amendment. Rexford Tugwell, great name, former Columbia professor, one of the architects of the New Deal, has this great quote. It says, to the extent that these New Deal policies developed, they were tortured interpretations of a document intended to prevent them. I mean, they knew what they were doing. There were like letters from Roosevelt to the Senate and congressional leaders saying, don't let constitutional qualms get in the way of your passing this needed legislation. I mean, if it was so needed and so popular, unemployment insurance, widows and orphans benefits at the depths of the Great Depression, if that was, urgent, pass a constitutional amendment. And if even under those circumstances, you couldn't pass a constitutional amendment, well, that should mean something about that skepticism that people have about the government. So that's really where we went off the rails and why legislators don't consider the constitutionality.
I think Mr. Shapiro just provided the best empirical evidence that I've heard for my point, right? So you've said that in the 19th century, legislators used to take their responsibility seriously to the Constitution, and other elected officials like the president, President Cleveland, took his responsibility to the Constitution seriously. We have the late 19th century, we have James Bradley Thayer, who says that there's a role for legislative officials to apply the Constitution faithfully. Then we have Lochner, right, in the early 1900s, which was far more aggressive with respect to when what Congress or any legislator could or couldn't do, right? So they read a very aggressive economic liberty principle into the substantive due process clause, essentially. And began striking down legislation with a little bit less care. And then we learn that by the time we got to the 1930s, legislators believed that courts would take care of it, right? I mean, FDR tried to pack the court, right? So you asked for empirical evidence, and I think Mr. Shapiro just gave you some.
We have time for one more question. Yeah.
It's one question for each of you. Actually, this is a comment about the issue of why people are taking, or why politicians are taking this commitment to the Constitution less seriously. I would say that you don't get reelected on the idea that you upheld the Constitution. You get reelected on the idea that you...
Until this cycle, perhaps.
True. But you kind of see that in democracies throughout the world, where you don't get reelected. You're just saying, I upheld the Constitution. But regardless, a question, one for each of you, hopefully quick answers. For you, I was wondering when you were speaking, I generally agree with a lot of things you're saying, but I was wondering when you would say that a judge should rule an issue non-justiciable, i.e. they just don't have the means of making a decision, or making a decision would really be disrespectful to other branches of government. When does putting the finger on the scales towards liberty go farther than that?
I'll give you an example. The global warming litigation that's ongoing right now. lawsuits all over the place. There's a case out of the Second Circuit, a case out of the Fifth, a case out of the Ninth. The theory being that utilities, energy companies emit greenhouse gases which exacerbate weather patterns, eventually cause property damage or other things that greenhouse gases cause and things like this, climate change and whatever else. The EPA is in the process of regulating these things. The political process in Congress, they're discussing cap and trade or something else, or the process is working. It's happening. There are actions being taken by the executive and legislative branches. For the judicial branch, on a theory of state tort of causation or of a causation theory of nuisance or kind of public nuisance, these sorts of things, to wade into that, I think would be taking judicial imperialism, as I said, sort of trying to take kind of a legislative role or an executive role in terms of promulgating regulations. So that is an example of something I think that is a place where the political question doctrine does have a place, where the court should abstain.
I'm relatively comfortable with kind of political question doctrine. So if the Constitution vests discretion in a branch or in a particular person, then I think courts should back off. But that said, I might interpret it a little bit differently than some people, because I think that when in Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, the word appropriate, that there should be more deference to Congress than is currently given with respect to kind of deciding what is appropriate. But again, Baker v. Carr and Nixon v. United States plug that test in to my view. They match up very well.
My question to you, kind of on the same note, but just applying it to your philosophy, where you generally you defer to the legislator when some people can disagree. My question on that was that basically any time there's any controversy, reason people disagree, reasonable disagreement happens on every issue, regardless of the fact that obviously you would probably say that the judiciary maybe shouldn't just cede this authority to the legislative branch. So, for example, Korematsu is a great example. Reasonable people disagreed about whether the executive had the authority to do that. As a matter of fact, 6 out of 9 justices said that the executive authority did have an ability to do that. But in retrospect, almost unanimously, you should. People would say that was the wrong choice. It really wasn't about deference at that point. It was just getting it right. And that was inherently wrong. But when should reasonable people disagree not be enough?
Right. Again, I encourage you to look at John Hart Ely's Democracy and Mistrust, which I think lays out very well when we should be distrustful. So I don't think there should be a background of distrust, but I think there are circumstances where we should be distrustful. You just pointed to an example where you have the subjugation of a minority group who doesn't have a political voice. They don't have the means to effectuate their will through the political process. And those are the circumstances where I think courts should be more active by the text, history, and precedent without respect to whether reasonable people can do so.
I don't think courts should be more or less deferential in any particular case. They should just do their role. I mean, judges effectively have judicial review, marbling us all the way down, is de novo review for constitutionality, not for policy wisdom or anything else, but for constitutionality of the legislature's or the president's or both action. And that's it. There's political question doctrine, in which case they exercise their de novo review and they say, oh, there's no real constitutional question there at all. It's a policy question. I defer. Or I abstain, rather. It's not defer. I abstain. But it's not, well, they're pretty much equipoise, these issues, so I'll defer. Never should that be the outcome.
I'd like to thank our participants.